Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot. I'm Max, and I'm joined today at the desk by Rory. And this week, we're focusing on the increasingly open question that is dominating Westminster. If Keir Starmer falls, what kind of Labour Party comes next? Because beneath this leadership speculation lies something much bigger, a battle over the future direction of Britain itself. Would Labour move toward technocratic Blairite reform under Wes Streeting? Would it shift back toward economic interventionism under Angela Rayner? Or could somebody like Andy Burnham try to fuse regional populism with social democracy? Today, we're going deep into the actual policy agendas behind the personalities. And we're going to be looking at the economy, immigration, housing, energy, and NHS reform. Not just who they were, but what Britain would look like under each of them. So let's get into it. What's happening inside Labour now is not just panic over polling. It is fragmentation in the party, as Labour is losing so much support, especially after this humbling defeat at the by-election, where reform has capitalised on the door being seemingly left open by the Labour Party. I mean, Rory, welcome to the studio.
Oh, it's always good to be here.
Well, if we look at the mandate on what in which Labour were elected on, they obviously, it was landslide victory. Over 400 MPs were elected, you'd say. And the Tories, only 121 seats. And obviously that was quite disappointing at the time. But surely Labour should have capitalised a lot more on this clear gap between them and the Conservatives at the time, instead of leaving the door open to smaller parties at the time, such as Reform and Green, which really didn't have enough room to grow at that time, would you say?
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. I think it's very important to appreciate, yes, Labour won a very big majority, and I know we've had this on the podcast before, but it is a very shallow majority. And a lot of those seats, often Tory heartland seats, their majorities are only 1 to 2,000. And so a very small swing away from them in the next general election, which is inevitable because people fall out with you when you're in government.
Of course.
Will lead to extreme losses in this case, but considering how wafer thin a lot of the majorities in these constituencies are. So they are very vulnerable. And I think that is, or rather Keir Starmer has been too conscious of the vulnerability of particular seats that has actually costed him his own political vulnerability with some of the decisions he's made, particularly within Labour circles. And this has been compounded by the absolutely disastrous set of election results that you saw 2 weeks ago. I mean, properly catastrophic Armageddon, or Starmageddon rather, results, particularly in the north, like Wigan Council, Sunderland, I think Hull stayed Liberal Democrat, but a lot of these councils, a lot of these Labour heartlands have been completely swept aside, and they are now electing Reform UK councillors in droves.
I mean, it's a massive change, really, because of course with the general election in 2024, a lot of the people, especially the Conservative strongholds, the reason why they were voting for Labour more was not because they were the best option, but almost least worst in that sense.
No, I would agree with that, but that's a good point.
Because obviously the Tories had, there was 14 years in power and there's been ups and downs.
I think 2024 was an election entirely based on the Conservatives, the hatred of the Conservatives, the Conservatives' failure, rather than any excitement or hope passion for Keir Starmer and the Labour Party.
Yeah. I mean, I was watching a clip the other day of one of the debate between Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer back in 2024.
Oh, nostalgic.
And obviously, Rishi Sunak was saying that, oh yeah, what plan do you really have for
the country?
These illegal immigrants. Because obviously, if they're under Labour, you're just going to let them roam the streets. But at least we have a plan.
Yes.
Even if the public might not necessarily agree that Labour under Keir Starmer, they are almost making it up as they go along. And that's whole country at risk of not being able to prosper.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's, we are kind of reiterating Conservative tack lines. But they have not done their homework on opposition, and you can see that now they're in government.
They had 14 years in opposition, and this is what they give us.
They had 14 years in opposition. They had three leaders in the time when the Conservatives had five, and it seems like all the Conservative governments, bar Liz Truss, has done a better job as far as delivery and progress is concerned than this government. So I think it does really raise the question as to actually the professionalism of this government, actually how competent they are.
I mean, Angela Rayner was saying the other day that Labour just need to start to stand up for the working people instead of being a party for the well-off.
Yes,
exactly. The way she phrased it. I mean, instead of tackling issues such as illegal immigration in a way that you would perhaps think that parties on the right, the way they'd be tackling it, they need to think more about how to help working people with the cost of living crisis. I mean, you saw Rachel Reeves was going to introduce some new reforms.
Yeah, I think actually a point that not a lot of people are talking about, but I think Labour is still stuck in this sort of era where they want to keep shifting the party to the right. And I think this was a process obviously started by Keir Starmer. But if you look at what happened in 2015, Miliband lost the election, and then Labour found a new leader in Jeremy Corbyn, and it radically shifted to the left, so that in 2019, they got completely... they got annihilated by Boris Johnson in the 2019 general election. And I think from then, while you're in opposition more generally, but considering how bad that defeat was, I think Labour was in the mindset of, actually, we've got to be on the attack almost. And I think the difference between government and opposition, as far as political and electoral strategy is concerned, is that a government wants to defend its majority, defend its mandate, defend the government, whereas the opposition needs to gain seats, and to do that, it needs to actually attack the government and needs to really push forward with certain policy agendas. I think under Keir Starmer, the party shifted back to the centre to appeal to more liberal conservative voters. And yes, they picked some of those up in 2024.
Yeah.
But I think he's still stuck in some sort of trance where he's almost trying to keep winning voters rather than hold the ones he's currently got. And I think you can see the actual consequences of that, particularly as the Greens are doing so well in London. Like, these are, like, go back 5 years ago, 8 years ago, when it was Jeremy Corbyn, these would have been diehard Labour supporters who would never have defected to the Greens, which was such a minor party. And I think it's now that, and I think also explains why Starmer's really trying to unsuccessfully adapt to the political climate. Obviously, you saw after the local election in 2025, he had a far more firm opinion and almost policy agenda towards immigration, particularly. That was driven by reform. I think this all comes down to the fact that he almost lacks a vision for the country. And it's almost like political parties like Nigel Farage and Reform UK almost, and the Greens and Zach Polanski, almost managing to sculpt this government and what it's actually doing without being in power. And I think that is primarily due to Starmer's inability to actually control or provide a vision for the country, but also the fact that he's still stuck in some sort of mindset where he's almost trying to win voters rather than hold the ones that allowed him to produce such a powerful majority that you saw in 2024.
Yeah, and just to play devil's advocate in that sense, if you look at the position Labour in, okay, if you look at them under Keir Starmer, you're saying that they've moved more to the centre. Yeah,
yeah, certainly.
If they shifted more to the left, how more difficult would that be for working people than, would you not say?
What do you mean?
Because they would increase people's taxes. Would they not? As in, especially with the cost of living.
Well, I think the rationale behind raising taxes is it's a practice. It's almost a mechanism of redistribution where everyone's going to pay slightly more, particularly rich people are going to pay far more. But that provides more funding for local services, which almost benefits everyone. So actually, a poorer person, a more working class person, might put £1,000 into the tax system, but he or she will probably get £2,000 back as far as public services is concerned, because a more wealthy person has put £3,000 in, for example. Now they're getting £200, they're putting, sorry, I've explained this badly. They've put £3,000 in, and they're getting £2,000 back. So they actually, they've lost in, like, notionally, they've lost £1,000, but that's being redistributed to a working class person. And I think in that respect, a more left-wing person would certainly help more deprived people. But I think some of their other policies mean that it really restricts maybe someone's ability or drive to actually work, because maybe they're too reliant on the benefit system. That's what you're seeing currently right now. So there are far more factors other than just its basic redistribution. Like, you've got employment, unemployment, higher taxes on businesses mean that they're unable to employ people,
yeah, I mean, that's exactly
as you've seen
what,
in national insurance. Yeah. So I think on the aggregate, a more left-wing person would help working people, but rather paradoxically, it might not help the country.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what... Well, I'm linking back to your point about welfare. Well, we're obviously going to come on to address this later, but that's one of the things that Wes Streeting wants to address, because he wants to cut welfare to boost defence, which we'll obviously talk about later well. But in terms of the public finances, surely Labour, they're looking at this now, they're thinking, okay, what is the public service that is our priority right now? And obviously I'm looking at the NHS here, and I'm thinking that even with Wes Streeting, there has been progress a little bit in terms of waiting list reduction or the number of doctors being employed has increased a little bit. But I think more investment into the NHS is needed, but it just depends, where is that money going to come from? Is it going to come from increased taxes? I don't think it's in the Labour Party's nature to really cut areas to boost other areas, would you say?
No. They're not really... If they're going to increase funding for a certain area, they're far more likely to do it through taxes rather than cutting spending.
And, I mean, Andy Burnham especially, I mean, he wants to just borrow more. That's just going to increase government
debt. Government debt, in my opinion, is the... arguably probably the worst actual form of government spending, because if you think about it, we're not really actually reducing the debt every year. We're just paying off interest, which just like is almost like a plant. It'll just grow back the next year and then you've got to cut it down again. But you're actually not like destroying like the roots of the plant, if we're using this analogy. So if I was Prime Minister, I would... If I was going to be responsible chancellor, I would probably make public service cuts. These would be strategic and tactical. I'm obviously not going to like chop down. I'm not going to chop down A&E wards in hospitals, for example. But yes, I'll probably reduce welfare. But that's only because I want to reduce this debt. Because then over time, you're paying less on your debt, which actually frees up money you already have to pay for more investment in other areas, or reduce taxes for more people, particularly working people and businesses. So I think that you need more heavy-handed and a bit more of a ruthless approach if you're going to talk about spending cuts and welfare and everything. And I guess in that respect, Streeting probably has my vote. In Labour circles, obviously, I will never vote Labour unless something catastrophic happens to my mental health and something happens. Anyways, but yes, I think in that respect, Labour are never going to cut tax. That's a good point. They will never cut taxes. They will never reduce spending. But I think almost the problem comes from the top, and it's just their ideological mindset. It's in nature, and they're just incapable of doing it. Like, it just goes against all their principles.
Yeah, and if they started to just cut everything, then they'd maybe start losing more support, especially from their traditional voters who they've already lost to reform. They start losing even more because they wouldn't be seen as the Labour Party.
Yeah, but I think if we really kind of dive deep, as ChatGPT would say, and actually looked at where Labour is actually holding up pretty, everywhere, across the board. I mean, people could interpret Labour as being red because they're socialist, or red considering the blood they're losing as far as councillors, and just they're absolutely being drained with power and political capital and MPs, well, soon to be MPs, but councillors as well, as you've seen in the elections. I think an area where maybe they're holding up slightly better than the rest of the country, still abysmally, but London is faring, I mean, the Greens, put it this way, the Greens underperformed, in London. I think actually it's quite interesting, a separate side note, how no one's really talking about the Greens anymore. Everyone was all cheering Zach Polanski, and then he had these May local elections go past, and he's only got 14% in the national vote. The polls were predicting he'd be on 21 in one of them. So I think he's really not really proved himself. But that's beside the point. I think as far as London is demographically, it's a far more affluent, generally richer area than most of the country, particularly the North, where Labour actually also do quite well. So I think it would be unfair to say that Labour is now a party of the working class, because actually, if you look at the results, in the more affluent areas, they're holding up pretty well.
Yeah.
Actually, no, they're not holding up pretty well. They're holding up slightly better than everywhere else. Yeah. Everywhere else, they're doing extremely badly.
That's not looking...
And those would be their heartlands, and that's just what's quite, not confusing, but how the most Tory of Tory shires in Essex and the home counties have been able to unite with the most Labour of Labour shires in the north of England under one banner. And I think that's what's really confusing a lot of analysts as far as what reform actually kind of stands for and who their supporters are, because you've now seen that you've united two extremely opposite peoples under one shared common ideology. And I think Labour have been unable to accommodate to that, because that just goes against all the political developments you've seen in the past 100 years.
I mean, you could make the argument, I mean, especially from Kemi Badenoch's point of view. I mean, she was talking on Sunday about, despite the fact that they did make losses in the local council elections, the council elections are, the Lib Dems perform really well in the council elections, but you look at the general election, they don't really make as many gains. So The council elections aren't really a full reflection of voter intention. I mean, when people actually head to that ballot box to decide who runs the country, their ideas will change. And I think you'll find that a lot of people who vote for reform in these council elections, I don't think reform will perform as well in the next general election, would you say?
I would totally agree with that analysis. I think some evidence for that is that in May 2024, this was 2 months before the general election, the Lib Dems won 17% of the projected national vote share, 17% across the UK. At the general election, when it came to it, and I would say the Liberal Democrats are probably on the more serious end of the unserious parties, they only won 12%. So that's down 5 points. And I think people see the local elections as a far more protest vote. But I guess you could, if I'm playing devil advocate to my own and your opinions and analysis, in 2024, in these local elections, Labour won 34% of the national projected vote share in May. And at the general election, they won 34% of the votes. And I think the Tories won 25% in the local elections, and they actually won I think it was 24.4, so 24% in the actual, when it came to the election. I think it's a very unusual time considering how high in the polls reform was doing then. I don't think that logic applies now, because I think you've seen a real professionalisation, particularly with the Conservatives. I mean, they would have been absolutely mortified by the polls they would have seen in the summer last year. Their average was in the low 17s, 17.1, I think it was at its lowest point. From a party that was polling at about 53% at the beginning of COVID, they've lost 2/3 of their support. That is absolutely it's unspeakable. They're speechless. No words to describe it. But I think under Kemi, you've seen the party been able to think through their policies. Obviously, you've seen their Alternative King's speech that they released this time last week. And I think you're seeing a far more clear, transparent, common sense approach and agenda that you really lacked from Keir Starmer this time in his term. So I think this is I think these are different as far as what the projected national vote share actually shows us from the local elections. But I think the Conservatives are actually doing, I think they're doing, when it comes to the general, the Tories will do much better.
I think
Labour...
people will think they've been in power 14 years. They have experience, despite the fact that people may have been fed up with them.
Yeah. I'll make some very brief predictions. I think Reform will underperform. I think the Tories will massively overperform.
I think the Greens will perform the way they normally
do. I think the Greens will slightly overperform. I think Labour will perform as polled. I think the Lib Dems will slightly underperform.
Yeah, the Lib Dems have sort of stagnated, to be fair.
The Lib Dems are... I mean, look, I'm no one to say, but, like, people coming on the television shows and they're saying, oh, the Tories are dead. Excuse me, can we look at the Liberal Democrats, please? Because I thought if you were dead, when you're at the hospital and someone's dead, their heart rate is just kind of leveled off.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the exact same with the Liberal Democrats vote share, except it's just going downwards now. So, like, what's going on here? What's going on here? I wish we had Daniel here to talk about how the Liberal Democrats are doing. But luckily for him, he doesn't have to face the wrath of me this week. But that is a side point from actually what we're going to discuss today.
Yes, okay. So that was a bit of a brief, not really brief introduction, but a bit of
what
analysis.
What went wrong for Starmer?
Bit of analysis from us. But in terms of what happens next, I mean, obviously there's the Makerfield
by-election. Well, yes, you've got three by-elections.
But in terms of, so I think obviously Andy Bowen has been approved by the committee to stand in the election. And I think that despite the fact that Reform were quite close to Labour when it came to the general election in 2024, I think that Burnham, just because of his reputation and what he's done, I mean, he was health secretary before, he's got experience working with people, and I think he'll be able to bring the people of the area together. When you say, I think he'll do well.
I think
he'd probably win. I'd probably say he'd win. And then I think after that, it's just really the coronation. I don't think Wes Streeting really stands a chance if Burnham enters.
So we've done my little mini prediction as far as the general election is. I think, well, okay, actually the by-elections in this thing go hand in hand slightly. I think that Reform will slightly edge it. I think...
You think they'll edge the by-election?
Yes, I think they'll win.
Okay, yeah.
But, so I'll give you my evidence, my theory behind this.
Of course, yeah.
When it came to 2016, Makerfield voted leave 65% to 35%. Before Reform UK was Reform UK, it was called the Brexit Party, and before that, it had its roots in UKIP, which were the two most Brexiteer flagships of, like, politics in 2014 and 2019, respectfully. So, I mean, if you want to talk about Brexit, you're going to talk about maybe Boris Johnson, then you're going to talk about Nigel Farage, and then you're going to talk about Reform UK. I think, as far as Brexit's concerned, it's very, very pro-Brexity in that respect, very pro-reform area. And I think it's very convenient that Wes Streeting used his press conference on Sunday to talk about Brexit and to talk about Europe. And I think that almost rattles some of the tails inside Makerfield, which are very much against Brexit, or at least they were in 2016. But I think some could interpret that to be a really like genius move. You're basically sabotaging Andy Bellum's campaign. And I think actually we'll get onto that.
I think he does believe it though.
Before we get on my conspiracy theories, I know Keir Starmer thinks that he's going to lose.
Keir Starmer knows that Andy Burnham's going to lose the by-election.
Yes, I mean, why else would you approve someone who is openly challenging your job to be let in for a by-election? If we look at the target seats, Makerfield, under all polls, I mean, I did some calculations earlier. If Labour was at 28% in the polls and Reform UK was at 21% in the polls, Reform would still win this seat. And if we look at the polls, Reform's at 31 and Labour's at 18. So actually, I've given Labour a 20-point advantage and they've still not been able to win the seat. And unless something happens, which it will definitely not, he's not going to win the seat. People are going to say, oh, Andy Burnham, he's probably got that personal vote. Of course he does. I think it's going to be very close. I think it's going to be more of a Runcorn and Helsby shootout rather than Gorton and Denton, when he had kind of three parties all going out and jabbering at each other. I think Reform will win. I think Burnham, Not Burnham. Starmer and Streeting have accidentally kind of almost worked together to sabotage this plan. I mean, Wes Streeting's talking about Brexit in one of the most heavily Brexit areas in the country. That's not going well. Keir Starmer is trying to this is a good, really good opportunity for Keir Starmer to I guess it's like a referendum where, okay, Burnham, here's your shot. He's going to come back humiliated and disgraced, not winning. And then Starmer's going to be like, oh, well, we gave you a chance. You're not going to do it again. So
I actually disagree with you there.
You do?
I disagree with the fact that you think that Keir Starmer letting him stand is sabotage.
Oh, it definitely is. 100%
No, I don't think it is. You know, I think that the reason why, because obviously he blocked him last time.
Okay, yes.
So that just shows fear. Okay, if he blocked him again, so it's just showing he's weak in that sense, is it not? As in it's showing that he can't even
That is 1,000% a factor, and I totally agree with you on that.
But wait, let me finish, Willie.
Okay.
So I'm just going to say that obviously a lot of key people in his party support Andy Burnham as well. So Lisa Nandy was campaigning, Lucy Powell as well. I think that if Keir Starmer didn't approve Burnham and the committee ruled against it, I think that a lot of these key ministers would just simply resign. And I think that's not what... I think Keir Starmer needs to keep the party afloat, as it were. And I think that it now is not the time for him to resign. I think he needs to set up the timetable. I think Burnham needs to get to Parliament, and then he can take on Streeting in the leadership contest. I think that's what should happen for the sake of the country, because I don't think what we need now is another leadership crisis in the party.
No, I don't think so, but I think it's quite interesting how you think that Andy Burnham is the answer for the country.
No. No, as in I think that now is not the time for Keir Starmer to resign. I think if you're going to do it properly, Streeting v. Starmer, do Streeting v. Burnham, and potentially if Rayner wants to stand up, then she should as well. We want the best field, as Wes Streeting said, with the best possible candidates.
And I'll be on the field, I'll be a candidate, yeah.
And I will be standing.
Yes, yes, of course, sorry, you outquoted me. Yeah, I agree with that. Bar the fact that, like, I don't understand why, like, Starmer's, as boring as he is, he's quite power hungry in the sense that he's not going to let, I don't know, like a quarter of his party just tell him to go and resign. He's just not going to. Like, I mean, talk about listening to the party and all, everyone's going to resign, everyone loves him. No, that's not going to happen. I think he's 100% doing this just to almost let this pass under the bridge, this water through the bridge, or I don't know what the phrase is.
Water under the bridge, yeah.
Water under the bridge. Yeah, basically, just see this challenge off. Basically, yeah. That's what it is, because I think it's quite convenient that is this seat as well. I mean, he's very much the underdog in this seat if you look at the demographics and everything, just all the other factors bar himself. And I think it's very much I think Reform's biggest advantage is it's a heavily Leave area, and I think Labour's biggest advantage is it's the very popular Andy Burnham, Mayor of Manchester. Well,
King of the North,
but Makerfield is not in Manchester, well, yeah, so we'll see how that goes.
We'll see, and should we move on to the next?
No way. We just got one more by-election. Okay. We got one more by-election to cover.
Okay.
And I think this also goes with Reform.
Yes.
While I do not like Reform I don't like Reform as a party, but I think in some policy, I do agree with them, but that's probably just because I'm a conservative. But I think, and I know this really contradicts what a lot of the people in the Conservative Party are saying, but I stand with people like Jacob Rees-Mogg and Sir Edward Lee, father of the house. There is another by-election, which has come in the wake of the Holyrood elections. SNP leader Stephen Flynn, he won a seat in the Scottish Parliament. He's very much poised to be the next First Minister of Scotland. So he's resigned his seat in Westminster. Dave Dugan has now become the SNP leader in Westminster.
Yes.
But there's a vacancy in his seat and the seat of another SNP MP, Stephen Gethins. So there are two by-elections. In Scotland, one of which, Stephen Flynn's seat of Aberdeen South, is very much like the Tories could take it. In the Scottish Parliament elections, I think the margin of Stephen Flynn actually winning seat was only about 2%. I think at the general election, he won the seat by 6%, but I'll try and get that fact checked. So I think the Tories very much do stand a chance here. And this could be almost a turning point where if they actually win this by-election, this could be like revolutionary as far as what the public view or the media views of the Conservatives. Oh, that everyone's saying, oh, the Tories are a dead brand. Like they, since the general election, they've lost five MPs, four of which have defected to Reform. If you can, I think there's a real power. If you can actually gain a seat from the general election, that really puts wind in the sails of the Conservatives. And I think that's
and
far
that's
more
the momentum because politics is all about momentum.
It's all about momentum. It's all about momentum. And I think that is far more valuable than some of the people saying, oh, well, we're not going to work. I mean, obviously, I don't want to imitate Kemi Badenoch destructively, but I don't really agree with the argument of, oh, well, they're a party of people who've betrayed us, but I think there should be some sort of accommodation. Like, Kemi Badenoch admitted it herself. Yes, we should. It's multi-party politics, according to her, and that there should be some sort of accommodation because they're not, like, Reform's not really going anywhere right now. So I think, as far as that's concerned, what I propose, as well as backed, well, it was Jacob's idea, unsurprisingly, but I think that Reform should stand down in Aberdeen South for the Conservatives to win. That is an open field for them.
Yeah.
And I think the Conservatives should stand down in this Makerfield seat so that Reform can be
so
let
quid
in.
Pro quo.
Almost. Whereas I think it benefits both parties. I'm very much less concerned about Reform UK. I don't really give a toss about them because realistically, what's one councillor turned MP going to do? But I think the power for the Conservatives and the advantage that gives them if they win a seat in Scotland, I think that is far more beneficial than these sort of the benefit of saying, oh, well, we're not like Reform. Well, I mean, they are sort of like Reform, but oh, it's fine. We don't need to, they're over-cherishing their purity of not being associated with Reform. And I don't think that's very, I think they're being slightly naive in that respect.
Yeah. So I just want to talk now about the potential successes for Keir Starmer and Wes Streeting and look at his core policies. So one of Wes Streeting's main priorities is NHS reform. Okay, so he wants to look at...
How unsurprising.
...the NHS becoming more digitally integrated. And he wants to have this idea of major AI integration into diagnostics. And I think that could be revolutionary, especially for making diagnoses faster. Patients are going to get treatment more promptly. And that's going to prevent a lack of hospital beds or a lack of doctors that are able to see their patients, as well as the increased waiting list as well. Because obviously a lot of these people who especially need emergency surgery are having to wait these really long periods of time, especially because of the junior doctors are obviously going on strike. And the idea of Wes Streeting not really doing his job as health secretary, because a lot of the time it was Keir Starmer who was having to negotiate with the train drivers who were on strike and the junior doctors. And I think that if Wes Streeting really prioritised this, this could be a way of him building back the public's trust, would you say, Rory?
Yes, well, I don't think if he becomes leader, he's going to be like, or shift his entire intention.
Not entire intention, but that's like...
The health department. But no, I think it's...
That's one of the things that we thrive in as the UK, having a free health service. Like that
right,
is our
yes,
thing.
Yes, I agree with that. But I think you've got to take... I mean, if you were the health secretary, let's just say, of the United Kingdom, and you were in post for, let's just say, maybe 18 months, perhaps, and you didn't really achieve much, but you want to run for leader, but your key promise is, oh, I want to reform the NHS system.
But you haven't reformed the NHS system in the time you've already been in power, as in... Like,
well, when it was your number, when it was your actual job to do so, you failed to do it. Who's to say that you're actually going to do it when you become leader and you have about 3,000 other jobs to do? So I don't think you've actually... I mean, obviously, these are really nice things to say and really nice kind of plans to implement, but I don't think he's not able to do it.
I mean, of course, when any person who's standing for leadership, they obviously make these promises. A lot of them never actually materialise, wouldn't you, Sammy? We've seen that in the past.
Yeah, well, none of them really materialise, but, like, this one's certainly not going to materialise because, like, you'd have no one with the passion and devotion as Wes Streeting has done. Like, I don't really... I don't buy that, put it that way.
What, in terms of the NHS changes?
Yes, well, I don't think that's something that would define you if you were the Secretary of State, i.e. if you were Wes Streeting a week ago. Not something...
No, but he has made progress, even if it's little progress.
Yeah, obviously, okay, fine. Situation, but I think, yes, well, I mean, talking about Wes Streeting and health policy is like talking about Kemi Badenoch or Nigel Farage and how he's going to win in Clacton. Like, it's almost a given that's your job. That, like, well, there's nothing really to discuss because it's all in the evidence.
Yeah.
So, like, let's move on to something more interesting than NHS and Wes Streeting, because we already know about that.
Yeah. So, in terms of his economic policy, it's quite similar to the one that Rachel Reeves is already implementing. I mean, only Andy Burnham really wants to radicalise the tax system and its structure. But in terms of Wes Streeting, he wants strict borrowing rules. That's obviously going to stop a lot of government debt from aggregating. And he wants pension fund reform to increase US and UK investment as well, and these pro-investment tax incentives. So he's sort of supporting a lot of AI industries and financial services and the competitiveness, and he wants to really keep the same fiscal policy that Rachel Reeves is implementing now, because I think a radical shift is not what the country really need now, especially with obviously the war in Iran. It's not exactly helping the cost of living crisis, wouldn't you say, Rory?
No, obviously, like... you almost want stability in a way. But I don't think... I think there's very much a difference between... I think when they came into government, stability was, let's just have good economic growth, let's not have unexpected recessions and then huge kind of spikes, even though they were not commonplace then. I think stability has been... I don't think it's been going up. I think it's been... leveling off, if not it's been going down. I think that's one of the core mistakes of this government, and I think that's probably been the real most reason they've not been able to kind of win over the argument as far as this is concerned. I think that at a continuation of the economic policy of this government, which is already proved to be unsuccessful, I don't think it's going to work under a new chancellor and a new prime minister.
Yeah.
So I think that.
Do you think? Do you think he'd change the monetary policy if he became prime minister?
If anyone became prime minister.
No. Wes Streeting.
If Wes Streeting became prime minister, yeah, of course he will.
And to.
I think the agenda would be far more similar than if Andy Burnham came in, but I think actually, whoever comes out of it, even if it's.
Well, they're going to have to change something.
They're going to have to change something, but I think they will actually. They'll be in a much stronger position to actually do something rather than Keir Starmer, because he's been in there for 2 years. He's basically, all his political capital has evaporated over winter fuel cuts and the family farms tax. So he's basically like a sitting duck. Whatever he says is going to be contradicted a few days later.
I mean,
by
Angela Rayner said that she was contacted for the role of health secretary herself, and then she just because Keir Starmer still believes that since she's sorted out her tax problems, that she could still have a position in his cabinet. But I think that you're looking at it as a sinking ship, and the right decision really from her to just decline the role.
Yeah, because premiership's
not going to be lasting.
Amazon came to me and they were thinking about casting me for James Bond. That definitely did not happen. I don't believe that.
No. That actually happened. That is actually what happened.
Says who?
The Times.
Okay, fine.
You have to take my word for it. I can show you the article later, but yeah.
Who said... Angela Rayner said that.
Angela Rayner has said that she was approached.
Yes, okay, fine. So the source is not from The Times, it's from Angela Rayner, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but she wouldn't have told The Times if it wasn't her.
She's a politician, you idiot.
Yeah, but she's not told any other sources.
Sky News understands, The Times understands.
Well, she's not lying.
Well...
I mean...
Yeah, she sort of is.
Not really, though. I mean, she's lied enough. I mean, the public don't really trust her, you know what I mean?
Well, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but I don't believe her.
Okay. So in terms of immigration as well, for Wes Streeting, so it's sort of linking to the same ideas that Shabana Mahmood was trying to implement, looking at tougher border enforcement and the stricter asylum processing. I think that's the right... the sort of immigration policy.
That's what the country wants.
And I support this action. I think it's quite important that we shouldn't have this sort of mass illegal migration. I mean, Angela Rayner, now this is this might be actually true, but she supports Spain's immigration policy and the fact that they like to keep a lot of these immigrants, whether they're legal or illegal, because of their economic produce. So they obviously support the economy. And for me, I strongly oppose that idea. I don't think that we should just be letting I know that if we look at Polish migration in the late 2010s, that was obviously very important for the economy.
I think the migrant debate has been far, I don't want to say dehumanizing because that sounds like some sort of green activist, but I think some aspects of immigration, and this is far more frequent in legal immigration where it's controlled and people can actually decide who actually comes in and who doesn't, is far more economically beneficial. I don't deny that obviously immigration is a good thing in certain respects, particularly with legal immigration, where actually people can survey these people, actually what skills do they bring, how would they affect the economy, because the number one thing is the economy. Are you going to get a good return on your investment with this particular person? And even though that sounds quite dehumanizing and ruthless, I think it's extremely important. Like, I don't want to bring someone into the country that's only going to make about, what, £3,000 a month, or £3,000 a year, rather, even though you're probably not going to get that paid that much. But hypothetically, if someone was paid £3,000 a year, I'm not going to let them into the country if they're going to cost me £10,000 a year.
So that's even if they're escaping a war-torn country, you'd say? That you'd still, you would send them back even if, like, so this is like their last, like, opportunity, and...
Well, this is 100% not their last opportunity, because where did you come from before? France. And the last time I checked, France is a totally fine country, so you can stay there.
Well, they might not have come from France.
So where have they come from?
Well, whatever.
They're not canoeing from Venezuela across the Atlantic.
Well, they might not be coming from Venezuela.
Well, where are they coming from?
They're from any country, let's be honest.
Okay, yes, sorry. Let me just get my speedboat out from, like I don't know, Vietnam, and just, like, cruise all the way to the UK.
Obviously, there's a lot of crossing, but the UK is a lot of pull factors. So a lot of people want to come to the UK.
That's not, yes, yes.
Then surely, if you just send them... So
does France. We have the same GDP as France.
So you'd send them to France. Okay, then they just get sent back to where they... So they're going to end up basically at where they started.
That's not my... That's France's... Whatever France does, that's not my responsibility. It's all about responsibility. Illegal migrants who enter the country illegally... Well, I mean, I said it. They're not my responsibility. I don't owe anything to them. If anything, they owe something to me, because they're...
But if they're legal...
I know it sounds like Nudge Frog, but they're taking my job.
Hang on a minute. So if they are legal migrants and they didn't provide any economic value, then what would you... You'd let them
that's
stay.
That's a failure of the immigration system. If you're letting someone in legally who is not going to bring anything to the country, I don't support that either. I think the things that benefit the country, or immigration that benefits the country as far as who's bringing talents, who's bringing skills, who's bringing the economy, if you will, to the country, I support that. But as soon as it becomes something of, oh, well, like, I've escaped a war-torn country. Yes, but you've travelled through about a dozen that aren't war-torn countries and you could have stopped at any of those. So why have you not done that? Let's say France, because, I mean, I don't know where else illegal migrants are coming from, but I think you can see that about 99.999 are coming from French shores. But that's my view on illegal immigration. That's not really the... I don't think that argument's really being... discussed within the Labour leadership.
And just touching on our final point for today, and that's, we've touched upon, obviously, Wes Streeting announcing that he was obviously going to run in the leadership contest, and that he would want to see the UK rejoin the EU in his lifetime. I think we should rejoin the EU. I think the whole... I mean, Brexit was all... To synthesize it, I mean, this is a bit of an understatement, was about sovereignty and immigration. That's why a lot of traditional Labour voters are now voting for reform. But the talk about Brexit reducing immigration has just showed us that nothing's really been working since Brexit. I mean, illegal immigration's obviously been increasing year after year. We can agree on that, can't we?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So clearly the supposed benefits of Brexit aren't exactly showing.
I think that the
correct decision would be to repair relationships with the European Union and rejoin, get the customs union alignment and have discussions about rejoining the single market. And I think that'd be quite important in an economic sense as well, but also just repairing relationships with our European allies.
Yeah, I somewhat support that statement, other than the fact that I do not want to rejoin the EU. We made a decision in 2016. Yes, it was quite narrow. But in 2016, the country decided that they wanted to leave the European Union. I think it would be, and people are going to say, all the polling shows that they want to rejoin. Yes, but you're dishonouring what the people gave you in 2016. If we use that mindset now, we'd be offering the Scots and an independence referendum because polling shows that they might choose it. I don't think that logic is very substantial. I agree with you that we should have closer ties with Europe. Maybe perhaps join the customs union.
Yeah, yeah.
Take a more Lib Dem approach.
Maybe not fully.
I think we should take a more Lib Dem. I mean, 2024, Lib Dems basically pushed for this. We should be as close as we can to the EU without actually being in the EU. I think we should have a more Swiss or Norwegian style relationship with the EU where we're very much aligned with them, but we're actually not, like, they're not, don't have any legislative power over us. And I think that really combines the best of both worlds. What I would say, as far as the actual, how we've really grasped with the new opportunities that we've got from Brexit, we left the European Union on the 31st of January, 2020, and less than, 2 months later, the UK went into lockdown, COVID happened. That basically knocked the country out for at least a year and a half. Then you come out in November, and then by February, you have a war in Ukraine and energy prices are going up. So the actual geopolitical and what's going on in the news and in the world more widely was not benefiting neither the Conservatives or the UK. And that probably, that definitely prevented them from actually getting through trade deals and new economic opportunities that they could have had.
Yeah. And I agree with that. I mean, you've changed the way I think about it. I don't think, now that you've said that and painted a different light, I think we should just move, have closer relationships with the EU, but not fully join. We both agree on that.
I totally agree with that. And that's what politics is all about.
So this afternoon at the desk, we've looked beyond the personalities and into the actual policy futures behind Labour's succession battle. Because the next Labour leader would not simply inherit a government. They would inherit a fragmented electorate, economic stagnation, rising populism, and a political system under enormous strain. And increasingly, Westminster believes the post-Starmer era may already be beginning. Thank you for listening to Beyond the Ballot, and we'll see you next time as we continue to unpack the forces shaping politics both at home and abroad. Thank you, and goodbye.
Goodbye.